It's Thursday, October 22nd. Just because someone's personal mic is off doesn't mean you can't hear them. We start here. In the last debate before Election Day, President Trump and Joe Biden get ready for a new experiment.
They'll have, in theory, 2 minutes uninterrupted to respond. We'll see how it goes.
We'll talk about which strategies have and haven't changed. How much do you pay for almost 500,000 American deaths?
There aren't even $8 billion in assets that the company has.
Might as well find them $1 trillion. They can't pay that either. We'll break down the settlement with America's largest opioid maker. And when he speaks, 1 billion people listen.
I'm Catholic, I'm gay, and I dropped my phone pretty much when I read this email.
The landmark statement from Pope Francis and what's next for the Catholic Church. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are 12 days until November 3rd. Election Day, of course, has really already begun. Between mail and polling places that have opened early, a little over 1 million votes are being cast every day. 41 million so far. But that still means there's about 90 million potential voters left, which leaves you going, what can I do differently that I haven't already done?
Hello, Philadelphia!
Well, one way is to use a former president to deliver a big speech for you.
I get that this president wants full credit for the economy he inherited and zero blame for the pandemic that he ignored. But you know what? The job doesn't work that way. Tweeting at the television doesn't fix things. Making stuff up doesn't make people's lives better.
That was Joe Biden's strategy yesterday, asking former President Barack Obama to speak on his behalf. It was a drive-in rally. You could actually hear car horns instead of applause. So that's one way to create a spark for yourself. Another would be to win a debate. That's right. Tonight, it's closing argument time.
This is so unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
We're not going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it?
Presidential debate number one was, to many Americans, just a sad, shouting spectacle. Debate number two didn't happen at all after the president got COVID-19 and refused to participate virtually. So what should we expect tonight? ABC's Mary Bruce is in Philadelphia, where the former president spoke last night. She's about to head to Nashville now for tonight's debate at 9 p.m. Eastern. Mary, is this going to be like the one true debate we all remember because we actually heard people speak one at a time?
Well, that is certainly what the debate commission is hoping. It is why they have put in some pretty significant rule changes here. We've never seen this. They are giving the candidates, at least at some points, the silent treatment.
But the change coming after that first debate debacle, President Trump repeatedly interrupting and ignoring the rules.
To try and prevent the relentless, incessant interruptions that we saw at the first showdown, the candidates' microphones will be muted, at least for some of the time, while their rival is answering a question. It means that they'll have, in theory, 2 minutes uninterrupted to respond.
Well, I think the mute is very unfair.
We'll see how it goes.
But that's my life. In the meantime, that's the White House standing behind me, right?
I'm curious to see what actually happens in the room versus what everyone is hearing at home, whether we still see those interruptions on the debate stage. And of course, we will continue to see what is now commonplace in this pandemic. There will be no handshake, there will be no opening statements, and the candidates will be at a safe distance.
Well, and so that's the visual, that's the theater. Substantively, strategically, what are you expecting from each candidate?
In many ways, Brad, this is a real make-or-break moment for President Trump and his campaign. He is down in the polls. He has been on defense, campaigning hard in states that he won comfortably back in 2016.
Before the plague came in, I had it made. I wasn't coming to Erie. I mean, I have to be honest. There's no way I was coming.
And he's down on cash. So this is really his last best chance to try and change the direction of this campaign.
All you hear is COVID, 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 COVID. That's all they put on because they want to scare the hell out of everyone.
That said, I think we've gotten a pretty good preview from his recent campaign rallies. He is likely to spend a lot of time going on the attack.
I'll bet you Hunter is a middleman. He's collecting. He's like a vacuum cleaner. He follows his father around collecting. What a disgrace. It's a crime family.
He's going to go after Joe Biden, likely go after his family as well.
I hope he's going to come prepared to talk about what he's for. But my guess is he's kind of signaling that it's all going to be about personal attacks. And he's
Joe Biden knows that Donald Trump is going to try and make this personal. He is braced for that. His strategy is going to continue to be to hammer away at the pandemic.
I'm going to try very hard to focus on the issues that affect the American people and talk to them. And
he's casting this as Donald Trump's greatest failure. And when President Trump goes low and attacks him and his family, Joe Biden is going to try at least to go around the president, to speak directly to the American people.
This is not about my family or his family. It's about your family, the American people. He doesn't. That's not true. It doesn't.
That was his strategy at the first debate as well. Sometimes it worked. Sometimes they got dragged down in the mud together.
And what's interesting to me, Mary, you mentioned cash on hand. 4 years ago, Donald Trump, he had no problem getting on your TV screen, your Twitter feed, like whatever. He was everywhere, and he wasn't even the president yet. It's just that he had this spotlight constantly on him. And yet, in swing states this time, it almost does seem like he might need some free airtime.
Yeah, if you are a swing state voter, you are likely seeing more Joe Biden ads than Donald Trump ads. And that is because Biden has been able to raise a massive, astronomical amount of cash in these final weeks. And the president, despite the fact that he originally had, you know, more cash on hand, now is trailing behind Biden.
Thank you to Gastonia. Beautiful name. 13 days. Can you believe it? 13 days.
So the president is still on everyone's airwaves a lot because he's out blitzing nonstop these key states. I mean, he is campaigning aggressively while Joe Biden is laying low. That's part of his strategy. He's also prepping for the debate.
We cannot leave any doubt in this election.
It's part of the reason why he's sending out his heaviest hitter, like former President Obama.
I don't care about the polls. There were a whole bunch of polls last time. Didn't work out because a whole bunch of folks stayed at home and got lazy and complacent. Not this time. Not in this election.
Oh, they're getting a little nervous over there, you know, the deep state, the Democrats.
But President Trump needs this debate. He needs to be all over the network airwaves. It is a chance for him to try and change the conversation a bit.
We're going to win this state. 13 days.
The good news for all of those swing state voters who are just being inundated with these ads, there's just a couple more days left to go.
I was going to say, you often wonder like what difference another ad can make. You might also wonder what difference a rally can make. We'll see if this debate actually moves the needle. Mary Bruce and the rest of the team will be on at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight on ABC, abcnews.com, the ABC News app. Good luck, Mary. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Brad.
And real quick, ads and speeches aside, one thing that has caused voters to turn their heads and go, wait, what? Were these mailers arriving to voters in Florida? They had the voter's name, address. They claimed to be from the far-right group, the Proud Boys, saying, we know who you are. We know you're a Democrat, and we've gained access to election systems. And if you don't vote for Trump, we will find you and come after you.
Good evening. The president has instructed the intelligence and law enforcement communities to ensure that the 2020 elections are the safest and most secure in our nation's history.
Well, last night, our intelligence agencies came out and said this was not the Proud Boys. It wasn't any American group at all. It was actually the work of the Iranians.
We have already seen Iran sending spoofed emails designed to intimidate voters, incite social unrest, and damage President Trump. You may have seen some reporting on this in the last 24 hours, or you may have even been one of the recipients of those emails.
Apparently, they've gotten their hands on some basic personal information of voters in Florida, and they sent out these mailers to confuse and intimidate people. Russia has also apparently accessed voter data, but no indication that either of these countries have accessed actual voting equipment. It's creepy to think that a foreign country could send deceptive information right to your doorstep, so be aware. Next up on Start Here, families had called for opioid makers to be held responsible for years. Did they just get their wish? Back after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
If the pandemic has exposed huge gaps in American healthcare, one gap that was exposed long before this was America's relationship to opioids.
There is a companion crisis underway. The already inflamed opioid addiction and overdose problem is actually getting worse, and it may not be a coincidence.
One element of the problem may be the struggle to attend group addiction meetings, the lifeline for many with drug problems.
This was key to the presidential race 4 years ago. It's been the source of pain and suffering for millions. You might remember that one of the country's largest opioid makers, the people who make OxyContin, were recently targeted by government investigators. Well, now the U.S. government has announced a huge settlement against Purdue Pharma.
Today's announcement reaffirms the department will not relent in our efforts to combat the opioids problem.
Let's bring in Aaron Katursky, who's been covering these lawsuits since the beginning. And Aaron, whenever I hear government settlement against a company, I always think, great, like the government's going to make them pay a few bucks, but like they never actually have to admit any wrongdoing. That's not necessarily what happened here, though.
No, there is a big number attached to this, Brad. It's $8 billion that Purdue Pharma has agreed to pay as part of a settlement that also requires the maker of OxyContin to plead guilty to three felony charges, defrauding the United States and violating kickback statutes.
Purdue marketed and sold addictive and dangerous opioids, including OxyContin, to healthcare providers that it had good reason to believe were diverting them.
Remember the aggressive marketing that Purdue Pharma employed over the years of OxyContin included these illegal kickbacks, prosecutors have alleged, to doctors to prescribe OxyContin, even when it might not have been warranted.
The kickback effectively put Purdue's marketing department in the exam room with a thumb on the scale at precisely the moment doctors were making critical decisions about patient health.
And this is the first time that Purdue Pharma has ever pleaded guilty to criminal charges.
And yet, it sounded like people were also not all thrilled about this. Why?
And yet, Brad, it is a frustrating settlement to many who have been working toward this goal for a long time.
I think it's wrong to say that anybody was, quote, allowed to keep things. The resolution here is very significant. It involves, for the company, three felony guilty pleas.
We heard from families of opioid victims and from state attorneys generals who have been building their claims, because here nobody is going to jail.
We don't want to see deals cut, plea agreements that, you know, result in people not going to jail, not having the day in court.
Purdue Pharma is going to, in theory, pay $8 billion, but the company is in bankruptcy court proceedings, and so the government's going to get paid out pennies on the dollar, just like any other creditor would.
The amount of money that they're going to have to pay is so small compared to the billions and billions of dollars that they made through the sales of Oxy.
And there aren't even $8 billion in assets that the company has. And so in all likelihood, they'll pay a couple hundred million dollars. Nothing to necessarily sneeze at.
But wait. Like the whole set, like they know, but they know this now, Aaron. So why would they even bother to put $8 billion on the settlement sheet if they don't think, like, make someone pay that, you'd think.
You'd think. The Sackler family, which controls the company, is going to pay $225 million as part of the settlement. And this is a way to keep the Sackler family accountable. But remember, Brad, the family, according to court filings, has pulled $10 billion out of Purdue Pharma over the years. And so $225 million is a drop in the bucket.
Wow. So what is the company saying about this? What's the Sackler family saying? Because, like, colleges and hospitals had already started taking the Sackler name off of their buildings before all this.
The Sackler family became persona non grata in the charitable world, certainly, Brad.
The Sackler name was hammered off the building in front of a group of people, mostly Tufts medical school students.
I'm here because I think, like many of us who entered medical school, wanting to help people, and the Sackler family represents the exact opposite of that.
Here now, they are losing control of the pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma, that they built into their opioid empire. It's going to become a public trust, according to the Justice Department. And that ordinarily would benefit the taxpayer because proceeds would be then distributed to different entities for use to perhaps combat opioids. Here, though, state attorneys general say that's a little weird because it puts the taxpayer effectively in the opioid business. And that's not where state attorneys general in Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York say that the government really should be.
We're now supposed to move from law enforcement to essentially becoming a government-backed opioid business. That's not how this is supposed to work, and that certainly isn't justice or accountability for our families.
They would like Purdue Pharma to be bought out and become a private company that's run much differently than it was under the Sacklers.
Both the company and the shareholders are paying a very steep price for what occurred here.
Purdue Pharma's director said, Brad, that the company deeply regrets and accepts responsibility for the misconduct outlined by the Department of Justice, and resolving the DOJ investigations, Purdue said, is an essential step in the bankruptcy process.
In this effort, nothing is more important than defeating the opioid and addiction crisis.
The CDC reports that since 2017, prescription opioid overdose deaths have decreased by more than 18% in the first 2 years.
Okay, well then, even if this isn't the feather in the cap that the DOJ and that these advocates had always asked for, doesn't this give President Trump a chance to say, listen, 4 years ago I promised I would fight for you in this fight against the opioid epidemic. Here we are 4 years later, look what we're doing. Like, this gives him a chance to take some credit.
Brad, this for sure gives the president a talking point that he has desired, and we know behind the scenes Attorney General Barr had been pushing toward this resolution, but critics wonder at what cost. Nobody's going to jail. They say there could be criminal charges in the offing for Sackler family members or for company executives in the future, but nobody's going to jail now.
This resolution does not provide a criminal release or an agreement not to prosecute for any individual, and our criminal investigation regarding individuals is ongoing.
And because Purdue Pharma is tied up in bankruptcy, the company will not be paying the amount of money that's advertised. So critics are wondering what this settlement actually does and wonder if they had waited, could they have put together something that would have been more than what critics called the mere mirage of justice?
All right, and Aaron Katursky, tracking this case since it began and now, this resolution, at least for right now. Aaron Katursky, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
There are about 1.2 billion Catholics around the world, and unlike most religions, there is one person in charge of that whole structure, the Pope.
This is a man who's opened his heart to the hearts of all of humanity. This is a man who cries with humanity, who laughs with humanity, who suffers with humanity. This is Pope Francis.
Well, yesterday, a clip from a new documentary came out featuring Pope Francis, who said gay and lesbian people should have a right to be part of a family, and what's more, that should include legal civil unions. Let's go to ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman, because, James, the idea of civil unions might not sound radical to a lot of people, but in the Catholic Church, this was an enormous day.
This is unbelievable, Brad. You know, I'm Catholic, I'm gay, and I dropped my phone pretty much when I read this email, and it is totally mind-blowing to me to see the Pope say something like this. We should be very clear. He's not talking about marriage. He's talking about civil unions. They have been supported before by the church. But the Pope, the man in charge of this 2,000-year-old institution, has never said anything like this so clearly. I want to read the quote because it's so powerful. Homosexual people have a right to be in a family. They are children of God. They have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or made to feel miserable over it. What we have to create is a civil union law.
His is also the most talked about name in the year 2013. When pressed about gays in the church, he responded, quote, "A gay person who follows God. Who am I to judge him?"
Now, the emphasis on the family, I think, is what is so startling. There have been horrible stereotypes around gay people and their influence, quote unquote, on children.
Compare that to Pope Benedict, who called gays objectively disordered, or John Paul II, who called homosexual acts against natural law.
And the context of this particular comment was a young man writing to the Pope and saying to him that he felt awkward to bring his child with his partner to church because of the judgment he would get from other members of the congregation. He then told this documentary that the Pope called him to say he should bring his children to church. This is typical Francis. He likes to make statements. They're not necessarily written down, you know, and in the church, you kind of need to write stuff down to make it official. But he knows what he's doing with these words. They are so powerful.
Yeah, how big of a step was this for Francis himself? Because he has expressed sympathy to LGBTQ people in the past, right? So it's not shocking that he might feel this way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, his message basically throughout his papacy has been one of love.
Holy Father, as you can see, everyone is very excited. And we are curious if you have a message before your visit to the United States.
Un saludo grande.
To really kind of emphasize the teachings of Jesus.
A big greeting to the Catholic community of the United States and to everyone, all citizens of the United States.
That you should love thy neighbor no matter what they do or whatever their behavior, however they live their life. And his supporters definitely feel this is an extension of that. We should say, though, that he is a divisive pope. Conservatives are calling for clarity on this latest statement.
Pope making headlines tonight, announcing a big change for Catholics who divorce. A change to annulments, laying out a new plan to streamline the process.
Bishops have been in open rebellion with him. I mean, last year they came out against him over his opinions over divorcees in the church who can take communion. So, yes, it's more Francis, but this is really, really big. And, you know, don't forget, it's a global church. There are young people in sub-Saharan Africa hearing this, the Philippines, huge Catholic communities all over the world. And it is really, really important. And I just want to say, Brad, you know, my own feelings. I remember my grandmother growing up in a very Catholic household. I'm very proud of my heritage, and I love to be able to say I'm a Catholic, but it's really difficult to reconcile that identity with being gay. And for the Pope to say this, for me, makes me feel a little bit more Catholic. And isn't that a wonderful thing?
Oh, that's incredible to hear. And I should add, we spoke to Father James Martin. He's this well-known Jesuit author who said, civil unions might be short of marriage equality where you are, but think of that churchgoer in Krakow, in Poland, where the archbishop, the guy with the same job as John Paul II before he became pope, that bishop has compared LGBTQ people to Nazis and communists in recent years. Now, if you're in Poland, that puts you squarely at odds with the pope himself. James Longman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Madam President, the asteroid's impact is imminent.
How long do we have?
2-3 quibbies, tops.
And one last thing. How quickly could you blow through $2 billion? Last night, the leaders of Quibi announced that the mobile TV service will shut down.
The mega dream here is this becomes the next generation of film narrative.
This was supposed to be the future of streaming TV. It was stuff that was specifically shot to be viewed on a phone. You had short episodes, formats that could change whether it's day, night, vertical, horizontal.
Do you know how long it's going to be?
Just a Quibi.
Mr. Chance.
The rapper. Mr. The Rapper.
It also attracted huge names from Hollywood and huge dollars from major entertainment investors, including our parent company, Disney. And yet yesterday, the founders decided they cannot go on, saying one of two things has happened. Either our idea was bad or our timing was bad. Think about it. People are watching TV everywhere right now, except their commutes. There aren't that many commutes at all. Money kept flying out. There was literally a show about someone with a golden arm with very little money coming back in.
There's very little I can do. You've got to take off that prosthetic.
No, I can't take off my golden arm.
Quibi now becomes the latest media startup to promise revolution only to bring disappointment. Remember HQ Trivia, live quiz shows for everyone? They're barely hanging on. Vine faded to the background until TikTok took its place. And big money does not like to take huge risks in new media. So this failure could mean the TV you've got might be the TV you get for a while. HQ and Vine, same founders, by the way. And yet, startups keep finding new investors. You can use those newfangled phones to rate and review us. Or if you're an early adopter, remember, Start Here is available on your smart speaker. All you got to do is ask. Debate night coming. Follow tonight at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.